Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here for another Wagon Wheel Show, the show where you ask questions about cricket. Or someone does. You can ask them when you're live on YouTube with a super chat if you want, but otherwise, Patreon is the best bet, like Abe has. So you can go to Good Areas Live Podcast and you can find us over there. But he has said, what do you think the role of a captain actually is in modern cricket? Given how much of the eventual decision-making sits with the coaches, analysts, and maybe a bigger on-field leadership group of players, is there still a strong case for concentrating the authority in one player? Yeah, I think there's... Look, captains still make decisions. Coaches and analysts don't make decisions. Apologies to those who think that's how it works. It's just not how it works. You can't do it. It's too hard to get the information on the board. I'd say the closest we've ever got that I'm aware of is when Nathan Lehman and Owen Morgan had their system of the boards and everything. And it was certainly something that I had thought about doing. Just because from a point of view of... Sometimes it's just really, really easy to get that information across to... a captain during the game with a board up, not because I wanted to make decisions, just so they knew what I knew at that point. And same for the coaching team. So no, captains still have a huge authority. And I think even with leadership groups and everything else, leadership groups, probably what it really means is that there is a group to talk to about different things. I don't think it means that you're making decisions by committee or anything. I certainly haven't heard of that, but if a bowler is struggling, rather than just the captain going over to them, if you've got a leadership person who's also in the bowling unit, they can talk about it more directly. So, yeah, I think it's different. Look, captains used to be essentially diplomats, right? Statesmen, maybe? I don't know how you would look at that. And obviously, as the game changes, they're going to change as well. But they're not, like, suddenly... It's still very much a on-field decision-making part of it. They don't have to worry about all the other crap, to be fair. A lot of stuff that, like, I think it's Mike Atherton tells a great story about being captain, and they had a coach, and when they got to the nets, the coach went to play golf and let them all do what they were used to doing. Like, we've come a long way from that. Sam says, oh my God, Sam's written an essay. Do you think someone could develop the same cult status as a Virat Kohli, Sachin Tendulkar, just through playing franchise cricket? Personally, I think however good a T20 game is, it doesn't stick in the mind and throw away forgettable the same way as a longer form match does. I think that's probably, Sam, like the era in which you grew up in. I think there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people who just watch the IPL or the SC20, whatever their league is, right? And a couple of other smaller leagues around that. And then they might watch your international team a little bit. Those people have the same instincts and memories that you do of test matches. Now, I think there is obviously something about test matches that are much easier to remember. I think the space in which things happen. I've talked about this before. Like, something as simple, if something huge happens just before stumps, there's a whole discussion on it, right? And that's very different than something happening huge at the end of the game, because you're responding to the end of the game and the incident. So it's all automatically diluted in one-day cricket or T20 cricket. But I can't see why a three-hour sporting event couldn't create, you know, these incredible legacies and cult-like status when that's what most sports are. So for me, that doesn't make any sense that you can't do that. We're pretty much in the first generation of people in India specifically, but even in T20 around the world, where there is a huge generation of people who've just grown up in that one format. And they seem pretty switched on and able to remember things and everything else. So, yeah, I do think that is the case. Honestly, I think what we will see is a change in... We've already seen, and I think Kohli is the best example of this, although AB was the first one I really noticed it with, of the sort of individual fan club element of certain players. It was always there in cricket. You can go back and see Sachin versus Dravid, and, you know, Murali versus Warne has little bits of it as well. But for whatever reason, that sort of fan club element that we saw come through basketball and soccer definitely comes through into cricket. And Virat is kind of the face of that, I think, or certainly Virat and Bubba are the faces of that. So they are still largely international cricketers, but a lot of Virat's is still down to what happens at RCB, right? And the runs he makes and everything else. So I don't really see why someone couldn't do that without being a major international player. I would say Dre Ross is maybe a pretty good example of, if he just comes through again now and play has the same impact, I would think he'd be like a lot more famous. I actually think he struggled because of the crossover era, right? Once the crossover is no longer there, like if you're not comparing it to international cricket as much, then suddenly the franchise stuff is as important. James says, given how important getting set is, why does the next man in not eat net? Even if it doesn't exactly replicate the pitch in the middle, surely it would be better than nothing. So James, I have talked to players about this quite a bit. So I've written this article. And the reason I wrote it was because at Docklands, they actually had nets set up inside the playing surface. I can't remember why, but there was a reason. And so we know that baseballers do things like that, right? So I was like, well, what's the difference then between these two where this doesn't make sense? And I talked to Dan Christian about it, and he's the player I remember talking to, but I talked to a few, but I remember him sort of saying, well, what if I got tired, or what if it changed my pattern and everything else? And I was like, I don't know what other countries are taught, but in Australia, we are taught that when you walk out to bat specifically, the first thing you do is you raise your eyes up to get used to the light level at that time. It's not something I see as much from overseas players, but I still notice it with Australian players. It was certainly what I was taught, which is you now have to get your eyes ready for the light as it is at this moment. Having a net out on the ground, on the side of the ground, would be the best way to do that beforehand, right? That's not always possible. And I do think in new stadiums, as they get built, we will start to see that more. But yeah, I'm with you. I kind of think it's something that should be done. And I don't understand how sitting in a dugout for 45 minutes with a roof over the top so you don't even have the light coming in is your best way of warming up. You know, club cricketers don't do that. It's really weird that international and domestic cricketers do. So I do think this is one of those things where it just became a pattern not to do, and so people follow that pattern. Ellie says, is strike rate the only metric that should matter in T20s? I feel like a lot of analysis reduces batting down to just strike rate. No, I mean, strike rate on its own means nothing, Ellie. So no, I would never use that as the only metric. True strike rate, I think, is much more interesting. But also, you know, the position at which you come in the game is really, really important. So if you are... You know, looking at those sort of impact metrics type things that Jimenez does and that we kind of look at. So when we are looking at true average, we're also looking at what time you came in the game, right? So if it's 3 for 3, it's a very different situation than if you come in at 100 for 3. What are the expected runs from the position at which you've come in? That includes actual average. I mean, it's not average, but, you know, run production, but also efficiency of that run production. Actual strike rate, we only use when it's a shortcut and we don't have all the other numbers in front of us. It's not something that I spend a lot of time looking at ever. So no. Aravind says, hypothetically, if this year's IPL had happened in an alternate universe where the pitches are more akin to those that we got in Test cricket these days, is green seeming nightmares... i.e. green seeming nightmares are ranked owners. Let's all assume they were playing with the red ball. Which IPL team would be the best suited to win given the same current squads? So we were asked this on a... I'm going to take a photo of that as well because it's a good question. We were asked this on a live. My memory of the answer was RCB and Gujarat were the two teams that make sense. It's weird though. We get these sorts of questions. I reckon I get these questions like every IPL. I think RCB... Yeah, because Gujarat would have Rashid Khan and they've got all the seam bowlers, and then they've got Sadashan, Gill, Butler. I'm missing some other people in that side. But so, yeah, I think they've got pretty, you know, a good ability to be able to do that. I don't think Rajasthan's a million miles away either. I don't know much about Bishnoi in first class cricket, which would be my only caveat on that. Although they've got the new guy as well. And I don't know much about him in first class cricket. Aravind said, You previously mentioned about having an idea script for a TV show. Have you found that it garnered interest when you pitched it, and how close has it gotten to being made in the past? Me and Atif Nawaz came up with like a script around, an idea for a sitcom around cricket. I think we got that as far as the BBC, and they didn't quite get it. So we didn't even, I can't even remember if Atif had a meeting, but I certainly wasn't at a meeting. So it wasn't particularly serious at that point. Then I kind of took the characters and went in a different direction, where what I really wanted to do was, put characters from a club cricket environment into extreme situations. So the first episode is them being attacked by aliens. Actually, that's not the case anymore. The first episode is them on a road trip that doesn't quite work. The second episode is them being attacked by aliens. The third one is their scorer, them in a rom-com situation with their scorer. You know, there's all these different kinds of situations that I put them in. That one got, how far did I get with that one? I got to a pretty high up production company, a production company that has made lots of big TV shows in England and America. They didn't get it, I don't think, ever. They kept telling me to make changes, and I'd make the changes. And then they, at the next meeting, they'd be like, we think you should make these changes. I'm like, but I have. Like, so I wasn't even sure how closely they were looking at the script, if we're being honest. I think they just wanted to talk cricket with me. So, yeah, I don't think they ever quite got the concept. It's a bit of a weird concept, you know. It's like the next step on from Spaced or Community, right? Where there are real world consequences for what happens in these episodes, but also a bit like Kenny in South Park, you reset the next episode. So maybe the concept was what part of the issue. So I got it to them, and then when the Ted Lasso thing happened, there was a company in America who were like, we want to make the cricket version of Ted Lasso. And I was like, great, here's my script. And they were really, really excited, and then just ghosted me. So I wouldn't say I ever got particularly close. It's still something that I have to make and would love to. It's something I would really love to make. I just don't know if it's going to ever happen at this point. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. PJ says, did The Athletic fail? How did it fail? I've heard from many long-term readers that it's turned into slop, and they've drastically cut down on team-specific beat reporters across all sports. With them covering cricket had made a difference. Is a cricket version of The Athletic ever going to be a sustainable business model? I wouldn't say The Athletic failed. I could tell you that I know some people that were involved early on and made a lot of money off it. So I think it would be hard pressed to say it failed. I say this as someone who was obviously sort of roughly aligned with them at times, you know, trying to get them to bring a cricket production up and editing it for them and setting it up for them. I feel like they were much better at the business side of things than they were understanding the content side of things. And so I noticed that I can't even remember last time the Nuggets had a beat writer, right? And this is, so Denver Nuggets didn't have a beat writer when they won the NBA championship, and they had one beforehand. So 2018, 2019, 2020, whichever period. And then I forget the woman's name, and she was really, really, really good. And then she went off, I think worked for ESPN. And they just never replaced it. And I was like, okay, so eventually they're going to, and they just never did. And I was like, oh, okay. So I think they were more set up to be sold than they were to actually solve the problems. But from that perspective, it didn't fail. I still read it. I don't know if it drags me in the same way that it used to. Partly because it doesn't have, you know, I mean, the main thing I want to read about is not on The Athletic anymore. So I'm more likely to, you know, subscribe to some of the other Denver beat writers when it comes to that. So it's kind of defeating the purpose. I have it from a professional standpoint as well, because it is quite important for other reasons. I've also got friends who write for it. So there is that. Would them covering cricket have made a difference? If they had come into cricket when I first chatted to them, which I want to say was 2020, 2019, it would have completely changed cricket media forever. Cricket media is so bad and it's so poorly run and it's so unprofessional and is just appalling. The Athletic coming in and doing that would have changed everything. And sadly, it didn't happen. I've talked to people who left The Athletic about doing it independently. I've talked to people from The Athletic about bringing it back on. Eventually, when they came to cricket, and actually, there's a really good cricket article on The Athletic today about Zach Crawley by Paul Newman. It's great to see him writing where it's not Daily Mail, where he can write proper articles, you know, longer form articles. And because Paul Newman has so much knowledge, he talks to so many people. And reading that, I was like, it's such a shame that like they kind of went with Paul Newman and a bunch of people that I don't know of, when we have a whole industry of people of which could have gone over in one big go, even if it was just like six or eight people, and just cover the English and the Indian side of things. The Athletic could have actually still made a huge change to cricket. Is a cricket version of The Athletic ever going to be a sustainable business? Yeah, it could easily be. Absolutely easily, because there is no beat coverage in cricket. Cricket is so poorly run. You could do an IPL version of The Athletic at the moment and make money off it, right? It's just that it's so hard to get investment in these things. But yes, I've done the numbers. It's not that hard to make it work in cricket. Cricket media don't get paid that much. Just paying them reasonable rates would get you in like 10 of the world's 15 biggest cricket writers. Abe says, there's been some criticism of the umpire in this IPL. I'm curious if you think cricket can have a more formal system of accountability for umpires in the way that already exists for players. Maybe something like demerit points from glaring failures to apply the law. Yeah, they already do all this, Abe. It's not always perfectly adhered to. I don't know how they do it at the IPL level, I should say this, but first class level, international panel level, they have a system where they go through, they check if people have adhered the law correctly. They look at decision making on the field. They look at all these different things. So it's been going on for quite a while. I believe this Simon Torfall might have been the guy that sort of started all this. It's a huge step forward. The level of umpiring this IPL compared to the level of umpiring 10, 15, 20 years ago is through the roof. I would say umpiring's almost improved more than anything else other than women's cricket, right? It's just gone absolutely through the roof, the quality of umpiring. So many poor decisions were made. And a lot of that is sharing knowledge. Umpires were kind of on their own, right? So they had a normal job. They were like semi-retired. You know, maybe if you're lucky to be in a country like England, which I think one of the reasons England had such good umpiring is they had so many games, professional games, and they were all working with each other. Whereas if you're an umpire in Australia or New Zealand, right? I don't know as much about the old Asian ones, but I'm assuming similar again. You were kind of working another job, and then you would come in and you would do a little bit of umpiring, but there weren't that many games. And you're probably only doing your local area. So you're only really good at doing your local area. So you weren't sharing knowledge with like this vast pool. And I think English umpires, that was the huge advantage that they had, is the amount of games and the sharing of the knowledge. And I think Simon Torfall kind of took that and then sort of inserted it into ICC culture, which has sort of gone all around the world. And so the way that we pick umpires now is much better than it used to be, right? So yeah, it's already so much more professional. Ajit says, I remember watching games where it was kind of expected that bowlers, especially spinners, are going to be poor fielders. I've watched matches where commentators were shocked. Even genuine greats like Murali, Vittorian, Narayan, Chahal would hold on to catches and would just laugh it off when they drop. Do you think we're finally getting to a point where fielding is expected to be of a certain standard, regardless of how good a batter or a bowler you are? And if so, should we now distinguish a great cricketer, which includes their fielding ability, from a great batter bowler? we did a really, really good chat about this on the Watch Along, I think, or was it another podcast? But recently, I think the athleticism, I always use Imran Tahir as my touchstone for that, this adjective. When I first saw Imran Tahir play, and he was probably already about 28, 30 by this point, when he's playing for Hampshire, he was one of the worst fielders I've ever seen. And it was so noticeable how bad he was. And now, if you watch him, he's like a good bad fielder. So I think there is, you can improve someone to that level. Like you can get them up. There really aren't many donkey fielders from Australia, right? So Stuart McGill was one. Travis Head would have been another one as a batter. Stuart McGill probably didn't improve, but I would say a lot of that is probably on the sort of person that Stuart McGill is as well, plus the kind of athlete he is. Travis Head is actually still not a great fielder everywhere, but there are certain positions where he's really good now. And so I think you can make bad fielders slightly better. I think the idea that you can make a bad fielder a great fielder, I mean, there is a reason why Andrew Simons or AB de Villiers or Trevor Penny or, you know, these sorts of guys are great at what they do. And it's because they have, you know, this incredible vision, movement, skills, all these different things that they have running through them, which makes them great fielders. Some of it is also the systems that they come from. I think specifically Australia and South Africa thought a lot more about fielding at a very early point in cricket, probably post-World War II, but certainly even pre-World War II for Australia, fielding was always a very big part of it. And that hasn't been the case in all these other countries. So I think there's a few different factors. But in the same way that we have guys, we can get someone to Glenn McGrath's level as a batter, right? Perfectly reasonable to be able to do that. I don't think we can ever get like a Glenn McGrath level batter to say an Ian Bishop level batter, right? I'm trying to think of someone more recent than that. It's not Pat Cummins. I'm trying to think of someone else. But like, do you know what I mean? We're not going to get them up to the level where they're better than that. But we can make them the best version of that. And I think that's the same with fielders. I think it would be unnatural to think of someone not being able to they're going to be able to do that. And what I was saying specifically on the watch along is if you look at spinners, a lot of spinners are very different kinds of athletes. So I've already mentioned McGill. You could throw Murali in there, throw Ashwin in there, right? All those guys are incredibly athletically gifted, but they're not athletically gifted in some of the things that really help with, you know, bowling spin. And you look back at someone like Phil Tufnell and Chahal is a really good example of this, is they just don't look coordinated, right? And they also can't bat. So if you're looking at the perfect cricket specimen, it's probably one of the reasons why if you really wanted to go line by line, Sobers versus Callis, that's a huge advantage that Sobers had. You know, he was the best close infielder, he was the best slipper, he was the best ring fielder, he was the best outfielder. Callis, fantastic slipper. Probably that's about it though, right? As far as a very good catcher in Callis's case. So if you really want to go to that end, that's how you can differentiate some of these cricketers from each other. But yeah, that just depends where you want to go on it. Katsukea says, England women did not pick Davina Perrin for the T20 World Cup squad. How would you go about finding the best balance between picking tried and tested experienced players versus exciting yet raw players like Perrin in a squad for a big tournament in a World Cup? So usually the experienced players in World Cups do better than younger players. Anyone who's been on this channel for a long time will know probably my next words are going to be, but specifically I think with these players, what you're looking for at a World Cup is problem solving ability. It is very hard for a young cricketer to have problem solving ability, right? That takes a long time to be able to work it out. Quite often when you take a young player to a World Cup, you can throw them in and they're very good for a couple of games, but eventually the world sort of shifts around them and people work out what to do. So you can get away with one or two. Think Misbah and Mushtaq Ahmed in 92. Pakistan's team is a really good example of very, very senior, solid team around them. Everyone knew their roles. And then you threw in this young batting whiz and this young leg spin whiz, and they were fantastic. But if we just look at that, we would forget the 500 other times that teams have tried that and those players haven't worked for them. generally, when you're talking about winning World Cups, you want the majority of the players to understand exactly what they want to do. It's a unique environment. It stresses you in a lot of different ways. And so from that perspective, it's even comparing it to, you know, players are much more used to the pressure now because of franchise leagues. But if you're playing in the IPL, incredible stress, right? But you're also only playing on Indian wickets. Yes, there's variability, but you're in your country playing on your wickets if you're an Indian player. That is very different than, you know, Adelaide Oval to Hobart Ale. And that's not even the bad ones. The bad ones are like, what? Not that we play many World Cup games in Pal, but Pal to Johannesburg, right? West Indies is maybe the most extreme version of this. You know, having, understanding who you are as a professional, understanding all those things, generally you would do that. Also, you look at Davina Perrin, and I just looked her numbers up. So she's basically played two seasons. She's very, very young. The first season was a complete failure. And the last season, she averaged 29, a strike rate 136. There's clear talent there. How old is she? Yeah, she's just turned 19. There is clear talent there, right? Oh, wait, what's her Big Bash numbers? Oh, yeah, and then she's coming off a Big Bash. So she's had three franchise tournaments. The first one in 2024, she was young and she failed. Fine. The second one was in England, and she averaged 28 at 136 strike rate. Then she goes to the Big Bash, and she made 48 runs in five innings, not quickly. So what are you even picking her on at this point, right? The only thing I would throw in for England specifically is someone like her. I just think that they have, in the last little while, probably lacked, which New Zealand has been really good at finding, South Africa has been really good at finding, India, Australia, I've had no problems, is finding sort of players that can take games away from you. I think the England team is very good, but they've kind of just, they're almost like they've got a ceiling and they can't go beyond it in some of these games. And these other teams can find that. But you would then need to make sure that the rest of your team is strong enough that you could take someone in who might play five games and score 48 runs, right? You've got to be aware that that is a possibility because she's had three seasons. One of them has been good. It's a huge risk in a World Cup. Hertz says, I've been reading cricket writing across all levels on Substack recently. With ball-by-ball data and tools now somewhat readily available, many enthusiasts are able to write decently and put forward their thoughts effectively. However, I've noticed a recurring trend of arriving at conclusions without considering the match situation, the role of the player, team composition, and any other situational context behind the data. How can one develop the right framework and intuition to derive actionable insights from the data? Is it just experience? Yeah, it's really tough. Like Himanesh was the Indian analyst, and sometimes he'll run something by me and I'll be like, well, but we can't do that because of this. And so it's just that I've been in the game longer than him, right? And I played a lot more cricket than he did and, you know, played to an okay level and had played with people who were a lot better than me. And so there are things that I have picked up, you know, through the, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours of watching cricket that I haven't. And Himanesh is a great analyst. I've worked with other great analysts who just don't know some of the cricket stuff. Most of the analysis I've seen is there's been an explosion in the last, 3 to 4 years, probably through Crick Sheets, of people using the analysis. But it's funny to me how often they come out with similar answers to each other. And some of that is good, but it's also, it's noticeable to me that we haven't always seen some big booms. And I think we're in a really lucky situation at Good Areas where we have access to Himanesh, Varun, Cheyenne. You know, we can stress test it with people like Robbie, Rob, Saurabh, Bayram, you know, CS, Estelle. And so we have a more of a stress testable system. Whereas if you're sitting there writing it on your own, I'm sure if you go back to some of my early articles, it's probably similar hurts because you get yourself in this kind of, oh, I found this thing. And so I have to tell everyone. But yeah, cricket is a really, really complex sport. Right, it's a fantastically complex sport. And so I think that the big thing for me was, and I maybe had this jump before some of these other people have, is I realized early that context was maybe one of the most important things. And so, you know, the first thing I come up with is true economy and true strike rate. And that comes out of, you know, we need to understand the context of when people are doing this thing that they are doing more than anything else. And so I start from there, whereas other people don't start from there, right? They're starting from different positions and where they're going. And so there's the, you know, this whole ecosystem kind of working within itself. Whereas I still think the context, you can't take context out of cricket. And as I said, I was very lucky. I read Moneyball. I did a short course. And then I read a couple, I read one of the big basketball data books. I can't remember which one it was now. Might be from the guy who did Thinking Basketball, but it might have been the other guy who went on to be an analyst. But it was one of theirs. And I was like, I kind of came up with a framework before I went into the mass of what are the things that I think are important based on what I know about cricket. Now, can I try and learn some of these, right? And so, for instance, true strike rate is great, but then it's like first five balls and first 10 balls is another thing that we have to learn about. And I think, again, that's contextual, right? You don't want a situation where you have a bunch of players who do the same role. And I think I'm probably thinking from that perspective, and a lot of other people are probably thinking from, you know, that sort of the more, this is cricket's Moneyball era, right? Like, and I mean this almost more for the fans than I do for the teams at this point. And so fans are looking for, oh, this player's not very good. I'm like, well, is he not very good? Or is he being used incorrectly? Or is he not very good, but actually in a different team, he could be incredible? You know, I talked about the Jamie Overton one before. I actually think Jamie Overton in a very good team is a fantastic player. This year, he's been fantastic for anyone. But I think he struggles to impact games if he doesn't have the ideal team set up around him. And so sometimes this year, he's been really good. And Chennai have still been losing games. Whereas if you flip him with another all-rounder like Hardik Pandya, he can have the same, as good a game as Jamie Overton, but because of when he's involved in the game, he's batting earlier and he's bowling earlier, he's going to have way bigger impact, right? And so I think that's, people have sort of lost that and they're looking for individual numbers. And actually what you should be doing is going, any player who's on your database is likely going to be a plus. It's finding the way to use them as a plus or to exploit that plus further that is the real thing. And I think that I remember reading Moneyball and, you know, looking at the early Moneyball stuff, and it was the opposite, right? It was, oh, we need to get this guy in because he does this. It was actually, what it should be is, you're really good at this. Can we actually make you better at this so that they even each other out and you're not a negative on anything? Mob says, what are the backroom roles in an international franchise team that can be filled or might even be better when staffed by non-cricketers? Which admin roles must be staffed by ex-players only, and how is enough cricketingness evaluated? I've seen an argument that the T20 is so emergent, it demands recency of player expertise, for example. I think the phrasing of this is incorrect, and it's not your fault, Mob. I can understand where you're getting from this. But I don't think you should be in a situation where you think about things from a non-cricketer or a cricketer perspective, or a cricketingness perspective. I think one of the issues is at the moment is that the analysis staff is kind of here and the coaching staff is kind of here. And the coaching staff is almost all ex-players and the analysis is almost all, you know, non-ex-players, right? And that doesn't make any sense. What I would want to do if I was working, you know, in this, and this is how I wanted to set it up, and I talked to team owners about doing this for them, is actually you want to pair analysts and coaches together. Because, you know, one of the most fascinating things about, you know, Combox at the moment is when Robbie and Varun are speaking, right? Varun is light years ahead of thinking about cricket compared to a lot of people who are really, really good at cricket, right? But there are so many things he doesn't know. And so Robbie can bring that in and help him with it. But also, when Robbie says something, Varun's like, well, that's not true because I can prove that here, right? That combination should mean that you get the most out of both of them. So it's not the fact that you need one lot of people that are non-cricketers and one that are cricketers. It's combining all the different people so that you can upskill everyone who works for you. And at the moment, sometimes these two groups work in harmony. But even when they do, it's the nerds giving it to the jocks to fix it. That shouldn't be how you do it. I think if you're doing this correctly, you want to be able to do that. Even more so, I think you want to be in a situation where you want your analysts to learn the basics of cricket coaching. Even if they weren't great players themselves, some of them won't be able to do it. They just don't have the skills. But ones who do have that sort of skill, and I would probably be a good example of this. I think Nathan Lehman was another one. Freddie is another one, right? Where we have been around cricket long enough, you know, and I think Nathan was probably a better player. But, you know, we've been around cricket long enough that we could do some stuff, right? And I've been at my best, I was kind of used in that kind of a way of, you're not a coach, but you know a bit about coaching. Let's talk to you about coaching so that you understand more when you give us information. And the opposite is true. I think the one thing that we've seen in that I thought was going to happen in American sports, which I haven't quite seen, but is getting former players in who have a good maths background, right? Like someone like Shane Battier in the NBA, to see if they can use that to understand analysis and come at it from that way. So I kind of look at it from that perspective, which is very, very different. As far as the T20 cricket is so emergent and demands recency of players' expertise, it shouldn't. If this is a professional world, like me and Freddie Wild picked out the deep backward point move for the fielders almost at the same time, right? Like I remember I tweeted it or he tweeted it, one of us tweeted it, and we were like, how is this happening? We picked it up, not quite in real time, but within a few months of it becoming a normal thing that teams around the world were doing. Neither of us played. Right? It's not about recency, it's about paying attention. You could put, John Wright is a genius. If John Wright's watching all these games, he's going to notice that. So for me, it's not about the recency, it's about paying attention. Nasser Hussain, you know, talking about once you've retired after 5 years, you don't know anything. So it's your job to keep knowing things, right? That's kind of what it should be. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. Sam says, I'm very invested in how people become invested. I'm very interested, in how people become invested and care about franchise teams. I find the whole franchise model incomprehensible. I think we know that from your previous question. I know the IPL has been going for 18 years, and you see fans who have genuinely bought into the team and really care about results. And that's not just the young fans. I personally can't see how that I could be that bothered about a franchise. I can't muster any enthusiasm like I can about a club or a country. Could you see yourself supporting the Renegades or the Stars the way you support the Victorian team or your local club? No, but that's because I'm old, Sam, right? I think one thing that people don't understand is, and it's fascinating, Sam, because both of your questions come from this. People really struggle with understanding that other people have lived different lives in different generations, right? And so what your question really is how could someone not think the way that I think about something? But you're talking about people who are 28 years old, right? Who for the last 18 years, right? The IPL has been the biggest thing in their lounge rooms, right? In their classrooms, when they're sipping chai, when they're hanging around their motorbikes with their friends, whatever it may be, right? And so for them, it's the biggest thing. And I know this, Sam, because I grew up in an era where test cricket was the biggest thing. And then I saw another generation sort of come in off the back end of that who started to think ODI cricket might be the biggest thing, right? And it's because if it's presented to you as a normal sport, you then have the choice of which one you want to choose. And when everyone is telling you this one thing is huge, then people tend to pick that, right? At the end of the day, Sam, and I'm not taking a piss here, we are all supporting people wearing fucking pajamas, matching pajamas, mostly, but pajamas, right? National identity doesn't mean all that much to me, right? My favorite team, as you've picked up here, is Victoria, right? Well, that's weird. Most people in Australia, their favorite team will be Australia. So why was mine Victoria? It doesn't mean anything. It could have been my local club side, right? It's just we invest. Look at the whole, my God, I'm going to forget the name of it, NFT thing. I had people telling me that this, and I was like, NFTs is no different than baseball cards. We have, as a group of people, have suddenly decided that this thing means more than it currently means. And so at the moment, this NFT is worth a lot of money, but baseball cards are sometimes worth a lot of money, then sometimes they're not worth as much money, right? Sports cards in general go up and down with prices. Artwork can do this, all these different things. We decide at certain times that houses are worth a lot of money, and then suddenly the housing market crashes or something changes in the housing market. We're all just making a series of decisions. And most of our decisions are made on what was really important between the age of 10 and 25. If you are a IPL fan now, chances are Between 10 and 25, the IPL was a pretty big deal. I don't know that many people over the age of 30 who take the IPL deadly serious, right? Most of them are still at least as interested in international cricket. So you look at someone like Rob Barron, who does it. He's been watching all these leagues for years. He loves T20 cricket, bets on it, and it's, you know, a big part of his life. Still, Test cricket and international cricket means more to him, right? And I can't think of many people I work with that aren't like that. But there is a generation coming through because the IPL has been the biggest thing in their life, right? That's exactly how society works. This isn't about franchises. It's all made up, Sam. Sport is made up. We have decided as a construct that cricket matters, right? And so now we are deciding in real time what parts of cricket matter. PJ says, why do so many franchises across all leagues opt for foreign captains, especially in countries where English is not the main language? For example, recent PSL game, opposing captains were Marnus and Chris Green. Tim Payne, now coaching the PSL, I didn't know he was doing that, also said on a recent Cricketer Tower pod that they have some players in his PSL squad who don't speak or understand a word of English and have six different Pakistani languages represented in their squad. I think the last bit is one of the more interesting things I would point out here, PJ, right? The last thing is, you're assuming that if you're a Pakistani, you're going to speak these six different languages, right? That may not always be the case as well. So it is, you know, especially, I'd say probably less so in India, less so in Pakistan, but somewhere like India, right? Where your players could come from anywhere and they might not speak English. They might not speak Hindi, right? They may not speak Tamil. So we're already in a position where we have that. This isn't that much different to what you get in football. You have great coaches who don't speak English very well in football who have players coming in from all around the world. That is part of the job of being a professional coach, I would say, and captaincy is a poor form of that. I think there is also a little bit of one of the reasons I think in Pakistan we see it so much is that there is a belief that the players from the outside are neutral and are not involved in various different factions and political beliefs and all these sorts of things, right? They're not polluted in the same way that you would be if you come through Pakistan, if you're from this region or this guy likes you or whatever, right? So I think there is a big part of that specifically. But I also think one of the reasons you see so many captains of franchise teams that are overseas players is because you're paying for like a 33-year-old guy with all the experience around the world to come into your team. And if you don't have anyone like that who's a natural leader or a natural captain, it makes more sense to bring them in, right? So I think when I was at St. Lucia, we had Kyron Pollard and Darren Sammy in our side. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. So how many natural captains are there in the West Indies who are really, really good players who are respected? And we had two in the same side. So someone else is probably either going to have to pick a young captain or an older player without that kind of record or an overseas player. So I think there's elements of that. I think there's also elements of sort of, you know, when it comes to culture and everything else, of do think some of the players, especially from Australia, I don't think this is as much with other countries, but I think it can be. But I think with Australia is seen as this advanced cricket culture, right? And so I think there was a lot of, you've got to remember when these owners probably got into cricket was maybe a different generation. And so they, you know, and I've had these conversations with owners before, not about Australia, weirdly, but about English players, where he's like, we should get English players in here and they should be the captains because, you know, I respect them a lot, right? And I was like, why? Well, how would that make any difference here? Like, what are you talking about? You need the right captain, whoever that may be. In general, though, probably less so in the PSL. I would say in the IPL, having an overseas captain is really, really risky unless you're 100% sure that you will not be dropping them during the year, right? And I don't know if you can ever be 100% sure with an overseas player if it's not like AB de Villiers. Ajit says, God, these questions, guys, they're so long. So hard for me to read them. Right until the New Zealand series before the T20 World Cup. Sky's form was pretty poor for the last 9 months or so. He had a good series against the Kiwis. His World Cup average was average in terms of batting, apart from that one knock against the USA. Even through all that, he was striking well against pace. Spin was his main problem. This season in the IPL is actually doing worse against pace now, something that most players struggle with the older they get. You actually struggle with spin before you struggle with pace. I know he gets the cushion of being a World Cup winning captain, but his lack of form continues. Do India genuinely look beyond him as the captain of the side? Yeah, when you get to a player of his age, Ajit, essentially all you're really looking at is, and it's tough, but this is what professional sport is. Is this just normal form dip, or has something fundamentally changed? And that's really hard to answer. It just is. You know, we were all analyzing Heinrich Klaassen, and we were like, maybe there's a shoulder injury, maybe something's changed, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly, I don't know, maybe his shoulder got good, or just start smashing the ball again. We're like, oh, okay, it's fine, right? Nicolas Pouren, he had been out of form for quite some time. And then bang, 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 bang. Right? So you don't know if it's age or injury or anything else. And you see this right across all sports. So I think with India, you'd have to make a decision. I would say that with the next T20 World Cup a while away, they don't have to make the decision straight away. But I think they'd be silly if they're not thinking about it, because he hasn't looked out of form for a while. But I don't think, let's say 6 to 9 months of bad form is particularly the end of the world, right? But at the same time, you know, if you don't have another tournament coming straight up, I think if they had another tournament coming straight up, I think Sky would be around. But if that's not the case, they might move. Hurt says, I often hear the commentary line, oh, he picked up the length of the delivery so quickly. In essence, picking up the length is the primary skill of estimating how high the ball will bounce as it reaches you and how much room you will have to swing your arms through the shot. More the first one. The second one would be line. Which bowlers are use deceptive lengths to consistently generate false shots? Is Prasheed Krishnan one of them? No, he's just tall and he gets bounced. So he's doing it naturally. He's not like using deceptive lengths. It's just that his normal bounce is not the same as other people's normal bounce. And so we've seen this with like Graham Swann's undercutter, which became Ashwin's undercutter. That's something that probably changes the length a little bit because of the way that you are spinning the ball. Back of the hand slower balls change the length quite dramatically as well. Most balls don't. Most balls are pretty straightforward. A heavy ball, when the bowlers say they're bowling a heavy ball, quite often that, again, is a bit like the undercutter we were talking about before. So pitch is a little bit fuller, so that changes it. How far away is Emilio Gay from playing a test match for the West Indies or England? It would be the West Indies now, won't it? I mean, so it'd be England now, won't it? I think he could have already played for the West Indies if he wanted to. And what are the concerns that each of the three parties might be thinking about? Oh, sorry, Italy. My understanding, and I say this without a lot of reporting, but just chatting to people, is that he will most probably be playing for England, that he wants to play for England. If he wanted to play for the West Indies, I think, just looking at his record, he would have already played about 30 tests. I think he would have started playing maybe 23, but maybe even 22. So he's what, 20, just turned 26. Happy birthday, Emilio. So yes, I would say from that perspective, if he wanted to play for the West Indies, he would have. And I would not be surprised if he is the new opening batter. I don't want to say 100%, but I think he would certainly be the front runner to be opening the batting in England's next test match at the moment, would be my guess, from what I understand. And I haven't done a lot of reporting or been on the circuit, but, you know, just talking to a couple of people, I'm not the only one who thinks that. So, I talked about the Paul Newman article earlier today. I think Paul Newman might have mentioned it as well. One super chat, Walnut says, if you would design a cricket club system culture from the ground up, what would it look like? What should be prioritized? A cricket club system and culture from the ground up. I mean, so one of the big things I look at, Walnut, is how does cricket grow in every different country? Because I think until you answer that question, nothing else really matters. So that's what you're looking at. How does cricket grow? And can we make a cricket club culture that can help that grow? Because you can make the best cricket club culture in the world, like in South Africa. Cricket clubs aren't that big in South Africa. So is that going to help? Or is there a better system that you can come out with for South Africa? So I think every single country is very different from that. I think if you were doing it in the UK, I think one of the big things would be, you know, can you partner with councils and everything else to make sure that cricket grounds are available to be used for everyone at a very cheap rate, so that you don't have to pay hundreds and hundreds of pounds just for your membership every year because you've got a groundsman who's mowing and rolling the surface and everything for you. You know, I grew up in a culture where our groundsmen, we didn't pay for our groundsmen. They were provided by the council because cricket was a community sport. So in England, that's a big issue. So you would definitely want to be looking at breaking into something like that in the UK. I think if you're looking in some of these other places, like if I think in Asia, you'd almost want to take it a step before that and be like, can we come up with a really good cricket club system that is maybe tape ball or rubber ball, tennis ball orientated? So we can see who the best players are, but we can have them in a league so we have all the information, not just in a league that is making money, which some of those leagues do, but formalized, right? So you can understand who's coming through and then try them out with hard balls, right? And do it. So I think everything is very, very different. So you want to understand what is the thing that is missing at the moment within these sorts of different cultures. If you go back to Melbourne, one of the reasons Victoria has more cricketers than New South Wales, but New South Wales has a much stronger overall cricket culture, right? Why? Well, one of the reasons is in Victoria, we have this very weird thing, or Melbourne, we have this very weird thing where we basically have two premier turf competitions. We have district and sub-district. And sub-district, for whatever reason, seems to always have a lot of money. And district seems to never have any money. And you'd have to go back and ask people why that is the case. But have a look at some of these sub-district sides. So that means that when you're coming through, when you're playing like district one, district firsts, when you're in the ones and you want to get picked for Victoria, some of the best players you could be going up against are actually playing in sub-district cricket. So it's again, when you're coming up with a club system, it's like, how do we come up with a club system that can overcome the gaps at the moment that we need? We need it to be, a pinnacle system, but we also need to make sure that there is as many people playing as possible. And I think those are the two things that you're really looking at. Can we do it so there is a proper pointy end to this, so that the best club cricketers are going up against each other, so that even a 27-year-old might be able to get a professional contract at the end, which is what Australian cricket used to be at its absolute best. And then separate to that, right, can we make sure that enough people are playing the game so that with the net is wide enough? Is it accessible to everyone, right? And those are the two things that I think you want to do at your best. And I think if you look, Australia probably does have the best club cricket culture in the world, because at its absolute best, that's what it was doing, right? There was all these different club competitions all around, but eventually it's a little bit because of the geography centered on the major cities. But if you can get to one of the major cities, not Darwin, but the rest of them, not Alice Springs, but if you can get to a major city, chances are that you will be seen by someone and you can go into the strong, and then you'll be tested in Sydney or Adelaide or Hobart or Melbourne or wherever it may be. And then we can see if you're at a first class level. But there's also, we have the ability to be, to be able to find all these cricketers. Because that's the other thing of, it's all well and good. You can have I remember having this argument with Cricket Australia once where they were like, we have the best development system in the world. And I was like, that's great. But if Steve Smith doesn't pick up a bat, you can't make another player into Steve Smith, right? So you need the reach and the development system. And I think any club's culture that you were coming up with should be like that. All right, that is it for me today on the Wagon Wheel. Thank you to everyone else. I think the IPL game might have just started, so you can all go and watch that. There's more watch-alongs on Combox. There's always something live. Sometimes I think I'm broadcasting, but I'm actually not even awake. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.